let's see what, if Katie has something to say right away.
Going to talk about some Donald Thiel right away?
Yes, I'd love to. The ecology of sense.
Okay. So you said you weren't going to use the words media ecology. So tell me about that. Why not?
Well, I've been rereading. I've been doing Don Thiel the past couple months. I started with his PhD he did for McLuhan. I have a copy of that back in 1954. First PhD for McLuhan, amazing PhD for a 24-year-old. And then I read his book from 1971, The Medium is a Rearview Mirror, best book of McLuhan until lately. Then I read The Virtue of Marsh McLuhan. Then that's even better, but complimentary to The Rearview Mirror, Medium is a Rearview Mirror. Virtual McLuhan came out in 2001, and then I read Beyond the Word, Reconstructing Sense in the Joyce Era of Technology, Communication, and Culture. That's where, after reading that, finishing it last week, I decided, I'm going with Don. Ecology of Sense is the new term. It's ionic. And I will read James Joyce Technopoetics over the next few weeks, but in the between, I'm reading a student of Don Thiel named John Fichetti. He wrote in 1977 The Critical Twilight, Anglo-American literary theory from Eliot to McLuhan, an extreme Marxist put down of McLuhan, very interesting. And so overall, the ecology of sense is the what I mean by the AP over the AM, and it's more of a physical over the Android meme, leading to the hex addict. And there's many lines in Don's books, Beyond the Word, that book especially, that are ionic. I read one beginning a few weeks ago. I read the word, page 31, the three levels of the word sense, S-E-N-S, or the derivative, the root of sense, S-E-N-S. You have sensory, sensuous, and sensuousness as your triangulation. So that's my opening statement there, Katie.
Okay. Well, do you want to talk about the virtual equivalent?
Yes. Whatever you want to talk about.
About some of that? Okay, let's talk about some of that.
The singers are gone. You have the floor.
Okay. So tell me about this serendipitous meeting that you had with Don Thiel that led him to want to write this book in the 80s.
Oh, okay.
That he mentions on the first page in the preface.
Okay, then I could do this. Let's do this. I hadn't thought of this, but this could be done. This is where it began. Let's bring up this sound, that there, and volume's ready to go.
1983, about Eric McLuhan's Menippean satire thesis on Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, yeah.
And I was interested in some talks you had given in 82 about, and you sent me the transcripts.
Pardon?
I was interested in some talks you had given in Toronto in 82, and you had sent me some transcripts of your speeches.
Yeah.
And I was talking to you then about how you're the only McLuhan critic who had mentioned the potential for Menippean satire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just discovered your essay in the Journal of Communication, I guess the fall of 88,
mm-hmm.
where you make a breakthrough about Menippean satire and satire in general in McLuhan's letters. So I was wondering if you had read Eric's thesis, in the interim, or wouldn't it now be appropriate to check out, since he took that stance, and you're saying that's the angle to reevaluate Marshall's work?
Well, yeah, I haven't been able to get a copy of it easily, so I haven't.
You haven't read it?
No.
Okay.
Now, Katie, this is me calling up Don Thiel, July 5th, that's X Day, in 1990. Hadn't talked to him since 1982. I introduced myself to him in 1982 at a symposium at the University of Toronto on the centennial anniversary of James Joyce's birthday. And then he sent me some papers, but there was no reason to talk to him until now, till that point, which is 23 and a half years ago. And I just found all these old cassettes in my archives, and I have a technology to transfer them into MP3, so lots of good stuff going to come forth. And I found this one, me talking to Don in 1990, reintroducing myself. And he says, I find out later that he did not order Eric McLuhan's thesis. you had to go through Eric. You have to write Eric, and he gives you permission, and then you write to Ann Arbor, Michigan University Microfilms to get a copy of the PhD called The Manipian Thunder at Finnegan's Wake. Well, Don Thiel knew that he would be, quote, competing with Eric, countering what Eric and Marshall were saying. So he told me years later that he did not order Eric's thesis so he could not be accused of plagiarism from them. So I don't think he ever read Eric's thesis. Maybe I, when he was writing the book in 2000 or so, I sent him copies of some pages of the thesis for he could look at, but he was very careful not to be accused of using Eric and Marshall's information since there was this ongoing, you know, low war between them. So let's just listen to this a little more. Don, you'll gradually recall who I am, I think, and listen to this.
Hey, the other thing I was interested in is, has your article on the secret societies been published in Alberta yet?
No. That never came off.
Is it, have you written it privately?
Well, do you mean does it exist?
Yeah, does it exist?
Oh, it exists, yeah.
Are you interested in giving me a copy, or are you keeping it under lock and key right now?
Well, no, I'm not particularly keeping it under lock and key, but I'd be, you know, prepared to give somebody a copy eventually if, you know, when I get a chance to get a copy, sure.
Okay, because... see, what I was going to say facetiously to you, that you've caught up to me, because I have a radio show in Toronto, a talk show, and you could say that the talk show is a kind of a Manipian satire on talk shows.
Yeah, I see. Well, I haven't heard. Maybe you should tell me when it comes on, and I'd enjoy listening to it.
Yeah, I think you'd really enjoy it. Now, the problem is it's a smaller station, so it's just in the Toronto area. I don't know if you could pick it up in Peterborough, but some fans of the show have put together excerpts from my dialogue with callers and that, and they put together about three of them. I can send you copies of the tapes, because I think... See, I was Marshall's, Mrs. McLuhan's first archivist with the thing, so I have pretty good knowledge of Marshall. But I think I'm the only person putting out Marshall's stuff every 2 weeks to a younger audience, and therefore having them understand some points that no one would know in general reading about it in the general media. And I really appreciate your article, because from an academic point of view, you substantiate what I've been saying about the satirical level of Marshall. Not that that's the only level he works on, but it's very important what you brought up. And also, I do a lot of work on secret societies, and I've been putting a lot of information on that. And there's only one other scholar, a man named Nelson Thal, who was a good follower of Marshall, that I've had the chance to explore the secret society angle of Marshall. And that's why you're the only other person, so I was really interested in what you came up with.
Well, if you'd be sure, I'd be happy to send you a copy. I don't have at the moment an office set up, so it might take me a short while to get it to you.
Okay, what I'll do is I'll send a copy of my sample tapes of my show to you, and then you'll have my address that you can send the
great
copy to.
No,
me.
I'd be happy to do that.
Because have you had any remarks, response to your article, or is the journal too small for people to notice the article?
Well, I mean, you know, I get response from people I know, but it isn't the kind of coverage where you're going to get very many responses other than from people you know.
Do they agree that that is something that came out of Marshall's work that nobody...
Oh, yeah, sure.
So
but, you know.
They agree.
Okay, so the conversation goes on for another 35 minutes. So back to you, Katie. You can go from there.
Okay. Well, I wondered if you knew Ted Carpenter, too. Did you
know
Ted Carpenter?
I knew Ted Carpenter, yes.
Okay, I was just curious.
You will see in the diary back in 55 where I punch Ray Birdwhistle, MK Ultra kind of guy who was hanging around Ted and trying to influence Ted. You'll see that. I could draw it up and read it, or somebody could look at the diary, look up about 1955, and I push Ray Birdwhistle up against the wall, arguing over Ted Carpenter.
because an MK Ultra type person was trying to influence
Ted?
Ray
Birdwhistle.
just...
They were trying to absorb McLuhan's information. McLuhan and Carpenter, they became known in 52, 53 what they were saying. And, of course, the Secret Council 10 sent me to suppress it. And I'm sure the American intelligence, CIA, were interested in stopping it to the degree they understood it. And Ray Birdwhistle was their man. He even got an article in the Journal Explorations, I think, at one point. So let me just see if I can, since we're still talking about it, I will try to draw it up here. I just go to Dobbstown.com, click on the diary, go down to 1955 about. It's not that one, this one. 1955. What do I say? 1965, 66, 57, 55. Okay. Here is January 27th, 1955 in Toronto. Marsh McLuhan stood in the hall. McLuhan says, "They won't give up their specialism. I can't form a unified team." Carpenter, I'm listening to them talk. Carpenter says, "And the administration won't pay me back. It's not going to work in the university." Carpenter stared down the hall corridor. I say, "I can get Bassett to fund an independent issue." Bassett was a wealthy media man in Toronto. Then I stared down the other end of the hallway. Then McLuhan looked at me and said, "Balbus is building a wall." He was quoting James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist's Young Man. And I go, "Yeah, James Joyce." And I said, "Is that why you blessed separateness in your counterblast last year?" He had taken the word separateness and blessed it in his counterblast he put out in 54. McLuhan answers me, "Blake," meaning William Blake, "would have been the opposite of holism in this century, too." So what he means is Blake was holistic in relation to the specialist tendency of visual fragment of space in the 1750s. So McLuhan, taking the electronic, totalistic, holistic television environment, he hoiked up separateness as an anti-environment. So he says, "Blake would have been the opposite of a holism in this century, too." And I go, "Yes, and he would have spelt it Bulbus." So then, here it is, February 22nd, 1956, in Toronto. I slam Ted Carpenter up against the blackboard. I say, "McLuhan says that we, each of us, are a pattern of information. Well, who is patterning Ray Birdwhistle?" I'm demanding this of Carpenter. And Carpenter goes, "Yeah, well, who blacklisted Dorothy Lee?" And that's all about the battles in the early 50s where the anthropologists were cleaned up and kicked out unless they were going to work with the CIA. So we're talking about the anthropological infiltration by the CIA and other factors. And Dorothy Lee, a great anthropologist, suffered the stigma of not being a, I don't know, first worlder. So on it goes. It's very exciting, the diary.
That is very exciting. Did you read his article? Did you read his article? Secret Society? Yeah. Was it good?
Yes, I did get a copy of it. Maybe I should find it and read it. Read it on the air. Yeah, it is good. See, he's the only guy that knew Marshall was into conspiracies and that secret societies because Don had come from Yale and his classmates were George Bush and a lot of the Skull and Bones guys in 48 and 49. So he was, I think another guy was George Carver, who ran the CIA for Vietnam era, that department in Asia. So Don was open to hearing this kind of information, so he and Marshall explored a lot of it. They studied a lot of Freemasonic literature, occult literature. That's in the 50 to 53 period. So a lot of the discoveries Marshall made were Don was right there with him. And Don introduced, you know, Ted Carpenter to McLuhan. He also gave McLuhan the Norbert Wiener book, Cybernetics, and the other one, The Human Use of Human Beings. They were a revelation for Marshall. It gave him a new group that he could satirize. So here's August 13th, 1957. Sue Bone is 6 years old. Was she born in 51, maybe? So this is her birthday. So when she was six, I don't know if she was living in the Halifax, Dartmouth area at that point. I think she lived up in Montreal when she was young. Here's the diary entry for Sue's birthday. Garrett Dean and Bob were walking out of the Mayfair Theater into the afternoon sunlight, only momentarily blinding, when Bob suggested they go over to the Banook Canoe Club for a swim. But first they studied the poster for the new Elvis movie, Loving You. That was the Elvis movie they had just seen. So we just watched the Elvis movie, and now we're looking at the poster. Garrett says, "Your offer is the perfect refreshment I need after basking in the heat of Elvis's voice. What a singer. It makes up for the obvious lack of drama in the movie." I say, "He's a strange and wild phenomenon. America is such an intriguing culture. When I think of my adolescence in Paris back in the 30s, I feel like we were Martians compared to these American teenagers. Speaking of drama, when are you going back to New York?" Garrett says, "In 2 weeks. I want to get ready for a few imminent auditions." And I say, "Did I ever tell you how I saw the word Banook in a psychic flash when I was young in Paris?" Garrett goes, "No." And that's the end of that entry.
What Isn't word did you see? It's very fun. What word Banook. Did you see?
I saw Banook? The word Banook. B-A-N-O-O-K. Banook. Yeah, Mi'kmaq Indian Nova Scotia word. It's a club that I later paddled at, but when I was a kid, I saw the word Banook, and I was talking to Joyce or somebody, and I thought it meant ban the book. That's what I thought it was, you know, the influence of ban the book. But it turned out to be an aquatic club, aquatic sports. Much fun was had there.
I bet.
But back to what you wanted to say about Thiel.
Well, let's just talk about the book, and I think it's important to start from the very beginning, because even the
serendipity. That's right. I forgot. That's the way. So what happened is that so I talked to Don in July 5th, 1990, and then
the phone call that you just played was in 90, but the serendipitous meeting was earlier. Right.
No. So what happened, over the next, he sent me his articles. So say 92, 94, every couple of years I give him a call, and we talk on the phone, and he said that my talk on the excerpts on the cassettes that I sent him from my radio show were the best thing on McLuhan he'd heard ever by anybody else. He knew I knew or that I understood McLuhan. So what happened? We moved to New York City in 93, and I joined the James Joyce Society. So by 96, I'm talking to Don a lot. So he's coming to New York, so I arranged for him to speak to our Finnegan's Wake Society. It was the first time we ever had a speaker, speak on James Joyce. And so that was pretty momentous. And so Don and I spent a week in and out. He visited Carpenter, who lived at Central Park South, with his wealthy wife, and in 97, Severo Lautrengé, who created Semiotext and a lot of the postmodern writers, came into America through Severo Lautrengé's Columbia University Press called Semiotext. He invited me to be part of a conference on postmodern theory 25 years later. This is 97. Baudrillard was going to be there, other people, and the other professor he was working with would not allow me to speak. I wasn't an official, university professor or anything. So Severo asked me if I had anybody to substitute for me. So I recommended Don Thiel. So Don Thiel came to New York and gave a great talk. And that article I sent out that I posted on my Facebook 2 months ago, the long one, that might have been the first time you read Don Thiel. It's about McLuhan as the fake Joycean and really a retrieval of Pascal's Jansenism. I don't know if you remember that long title. And how McLuhan was the precursor of postmodernism. So what it is that it's like 15 pages. If you go on my Facebook, you see each page from Severo Lautrengé's book, which came out a few years later, 2001 or so. So anyways, Don did this talk, and I was part of that, but then Severo invited me to Banff in substitute for not being allowed to speak in New York. So I went to Banff, Alberta, and did some stuff there. So then Don, then I got him to come to the McLuhan conference in March 98 at Lincoln Center that Lance Strait and Fordham University was putting on in honor of McLuhan's 30th anniversary of him being at Fordham for a year in 67. So Don came to that, and he was so disgusted at all these younger McLuhan scholars talking about McLuhan and knew nothing. He also was mad at Terrence Gordon, who Sue met in a used bookstore in Acadia University, Wolfville, Nova Scotia, a few years ago by accident, in the centenary, 2011 year, and met Terrence Gordon. He lives in Nova Scotia. He wrote the book there, and he kind of slandered Don. So Don was either going to sue Terrence Gordon or do something else. So he decided to write this new book, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, to correct Terrence Gordon and Philip Marshall and everybody else had written on McLuhan. And I was intimately involved in that. You know, I brought him to the festa, to the McLuhan symposium. That's when he saw what was going on in McLuhan land, and he didn't like what was happening. So I was his confidant in that period where he decided he's going to have to write another book on McLuhan, which he didn't want to do. And so he did The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, and we're glad he did. And it turns out to be part of a trilogy. The first one, Beyond the Word, 1995. James Joyce's Technopoetics, 1997. And then The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, 2001. Those three books are mandatory for understanding ION.
Okay.
So that's the serendipitous... That's the serendipitous beginning of me and Don getting together and how I was there with him when he decided to write The Virtual Marshall McLuhan. And that's what he says in the first sentence. Due to a bunch of events with Bob Dobbs, this book came into being.
Right. In the first sentence. Okay. So let's talk about what The Virtual McLuhan means. So the title refers to Marshall's poetic image that he crafted. So there was the real Marshall, and then there was the imaginary one created by the McLuhanites, and then this poetic image, evidently, is what Don's trying to put down.
And then there's the one made by Madison Avenue, largely created by Tom Wolfe, the new journalist of New York City. So I refer to it as that's the Madison Avenue McLuhan. That's the iconic McLuhan. So if you look at my chart, which is 1960, 1990, Marshall McLuhan, as the public gnome, was created by the Android meme. He, like Zapp and everybody else on the chart, was an image in the media, orchestrated by the Pentad managers to siphon off energies so people would not notice some actual things going on. The virtual Marshall McLuhan refers to the image McLuhan succumbed to or battled with or couldn't stop being created around him by the Madison Avenue mainstream media, right? So it's within the global theater at that point by 1967. So that's the virtual Marshall McLuhan. And so Don writes a book saying who the chemical body Marshall McLuhan was. What was he up to, in spite of what the Global Theater said Marshall was about? So that's it. He's exposing, correcting, clarifying the iconic Marshall McLuhan image.
And the virtual Marshall McLuhan is far deeper than the Madison Avenue iconic one.
And the Madison Avenue makes the virtual McLuhan. Virtual McLuhan is the image that the media say about Marshall McLuhan, all the articles and TV shows about McLuhan. He's the guy who came up with the phrase, according to Madison Avenue, the medium is the message. He's the guy who came up with the phrase, the global village. Those cliches that are said about McLuhan, that he's a technological determinist or this or that or a devout Catholic, all those things are part of the media scattershot of McLuhanism. And Don is going to correct that to the degree he can by taking an old chemical body medium in a book and write about what the real Marshall McLuhan was about. Now, Marshall knew that he was up against a simulated image of himself, and he had strategies to play off it, and that's what Don Thiel describes in his book, the Marshall's reaction to his image that the media creates for anybody, like your nieces. They will have an image that they will not be able to completely control. Unless they know how to handle it. I have an image. Carolyn has an image. ION has an image. that is independent of our particular chemical body maneuvers.
Okay, I misunderstood that because I thought that the title referred to, I'll just read the first line of the introduction to the paperback edition. The virtual Marshall McLuhan stresses the poetic image that Marshall McLuhan crafted to support his persona as an intellectual committed to a unique perceptualist poetic vision of everyday life in the post-electric new media world. This persona, the virtual McLuhan, is very different from both what we call the real Marshall McLuhan, a devout, dedicated Roman Catholic academic deeply enmeshed in the humanistic and theological orientation of the classical era and the High Middle Ages, and the imaginary McLuhan created by various McLuhanisms and McLuhanites. So I thought that this had to do with what was important to Marshall.
Right. Now that's the back
the title
of the book. That's the blurb on the back of the book?
No, this is the first paragraph of the introduction to the paperback edition.
Well, who writes the introduction?
Donald does.
Well, it's all mixed up.
Thiel wrote it.
They say that it's a. They say Thiel wrote this introduction.
Well, it doesn't say that he didn't. It's not credited to anybody else, and it's really in Thiel's style. I mean, he's an incredible writer.
It's all mixed up. It sounds like the academic press wrote that. I could go upstairs and look at the hard copy and see if that's the same introduction. Is that the introduction that's added to the second?
This is the introduction that's added to the paperback. So maybe somebody else wrote it.
Yeah, it's all mixed up. You've got the five bodies, and they're mixing up the Madison Avenue TV body with the chemical body of McLuhan, with the chip version now, the recycling of McLuhan in the chip body era. All that is not well. It's not well said. So I'm just grabbing my copy of the hard copy. Let's see if this is what they got here. So, preface. That's by Don. Prelude. McLuhan's basic probes and perceptions. Virtual.
Yeah, you're missing the section because this introduction to the paperback edition comes before the prelude, McLuhan's basic probes and perceptions.
Right.
They have a couple of pages.
They have an introduction. This introduction is who/what is Marshall McLuhan? And it starts off with talking about the Mechanical Bride and how McLuhan gave a copy to Don and his wife, and he signed it to Don and Joan from the Mechanical Bridegroom Marshall. So, yes, your introduction is somebody else's mixed up stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's just to the paperback edition because beyond that, I have everything the same as you do.
Well, yeah, when did the paperback come out? Got a date there?
It came out in 06.
Okay, well, he was alive till 2008, if you're sure about that. But I think that's not written by him. It's erroneous, the way I'm saying.
Okay.
Anyways, that's interesting. It's not in Don's book.
Well, let me tell you it's not in the original. Let me tell you a couple other things that the paperback says here in this introduction to the paperback edition, since you haven't seen it. And then we'll move on to the... you can't just start with chapter one in this book.
Right.
You really have to look at the prelude in the introduction because they're full of information too.
Yeah.
He talks about being influenced by Pound's advice to start looking for credits rather than debits and how it doesn't matter so much where man got what he did, but what he did with it or without it after he got it.
That's what Pound said to McLuhan. But Don is going to show, Don's going to do the opposite. He is going to show where McLuhan got it.
Right.
So
are you
translating a sentence, or what does the sentence saying?
No, it's saying he got this from Pound's advice in a letter that Pound had written to him.
And yes, here's what it is. You read the letters. McLuhan's trying to find out where Pound got this or that, and Pound gets pissed off at him, and Pound's in a mental asylum down in Washington, in mental hospital for treason, you know, during World War II. But he's corresponding and talking to everybody. And he complains to Marshall, says, it doesn't matter where anybody got anything from. It's what they do with it. So he disagrees with Marshall's curiosity about where Pound got some stuff. But Don's whole purpose in this book is to show how much McLuhan got from Joyce and the vortices of Wyndham Lewis, and how McLuhan actually screwed up. Have you read the whole book? Do you know that point?
No, I've only read up through the first chapter. So all right. of the intros and prefaces and preludes.
Right. Don posits a conspiracy theory that McLuhan lied about being a Joycean on behalf of Wyndham Lewis, and diminished Finnegan's Wake and diminished Joyce's work, simplified it with his mediacology. And Don's job is, in his books, is to retrieve where Marshall got it from, redo what Marshall did, and not make the same mistakes as Marshall did. That's the interesting point about the book.
Wow.
But you wouldn't know it yet. Yes, you will look for that.
No, I don't know that yet. I will look for that.
So, okay, go ahead.
So moving along in this introduction to the paperback edition, he talks about influences. Of course, you just mentioned the Wake, plus Harold Innes and Norbert Wiener, or is it Wiener?
Wiener. Norbert Wiener.
It's more fun if it's Wiener. His Catholicism, radical modernism, and Lewis, and how he was shaped largely by Lewis and had an interest in communicating via aphorism.
Yes, via the aphorism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, and the Madison Avenue version is, and this would be Madison Avenue version of the academics' take. The academics who fall for the Madison Avenue version, they think McLuhan was a ripoff of Harold Innes or a footnote to Harold Innes and this and that. They do not know about the Finnegan's Wake background. So Don is first of all correcting that Marshall was not influenced by Innes the way the academia says he is. That Marshall was interviewed by Eisenstein, the Russian filmmaker, Moholy Nagy, the artist, a lot of Bauhaus people, not just poets, not just writers, many media people, many different forms, plus his own studies of medieval literature. So Don, you will notice that Don repeats himself in every chapter. He basically says the same thing about this background to McLuhan, but highlights one or two of those backgrounds in each chapter. You know what I mean? But Don's book is a very deep Veronian satire, which is the Carnivalesque version of Menippean satire. He makes a distinction between James Joyce being a Veronian satirist as opposed to a Menippean satirist. Menippean being more cynical, hard laughter, that's Wyndham Lewis. Marshall tended to be on Lewis's Menippean side, whereas the other kind of satire, similar, same thing, but different name, Veronian, after Vero, the Roman writer, you know, at the time of Christ, say. Veronian satire is what James Joyce really is. So Don represents the Veronian tradition against the hard, cynical Menippean tradition. And all this is spelled out in the book. This book gives you an incredible education on the hidden currents in Western knowledge.
Mm-hmm. He's a way better writer than Marshall, too.
In terms of explaining things.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, yeah, and that's a good, I would wait for you to finish the book before talking about that, because definitely Don is redoing mediacology differently than McLuhan, and he's doing it, not that he thinks Marshall was erroneous, or he acknowledges Marshall was a genius and incredible, a poet who got attention with his style, but it had a disservice. So Don purposely writes differently than Marshall did about the same
thing. Well, it's just more clear. It's just more clear, that's all.
Yeah, yeah.
And Marshall probably wrote the way he wrote. Well, I've heard him talk about it, or read of him talking about it. Like he was ambivalent on purpose.
That's right.
He never wanted to commit to anything. He was always exploring like a nomad.
Well, wait a minute. He cites Francis Bacon. McLuhan cites Francis Bacon. There's two methods that Bacon lays out for science or spreading knowledge. The scientific empiricist one the writer tries to fill in all the details and make everything clear and dot the T's, cross the T's, dot the I's, and things like that. Whereas the other method of imparting information is called the aphoristic method, where you do not tell everybody the whole story. You say aphorisms like the medium is the message, and you have to use your noodle, as McLuhan would call it, to figure out what that meant. So the aphorism leaves room for engagement, for participation, whereas the other method is clear prose, paragraph after paragraph, spelling out every detail, even gets into mathematics. That's the two kind of schools at the time of Shakespeare. That's the two kinds of science that are coming in with the printing press. The mathematical prose version of science wins for 300 years. Then the electric age comes in, where people get information overload, and they have to start doing what McLuhan calls mythic thinking, encapsulating huge processes of landscapes of data and making quick slogans. And those quick slogans tend to favor the aphoristic style. So McLuhan predicted that the aphoristic style, especially through advertising, would be retrieved and knock out the detailed scientific prose style that dominated for 300 years. And so here we are, 80 years later, and McLuhan's right. Science, they don't even bother spelling out what the string theory is. They just get their TV special and get up there and claim acoustic space is running matter. string theory. Mm-hmm. And so the aphoristic was retrieved, or you could say the right hemisphere within Western literacy was retrieved under electric conditions, whereas the prose, more precise, detailed form of science ruled during the printing press era, when that was the only medium people had. So this is what McLuhanism is. You look at the technological ground, which is the most prominent form of communication, and you see which parts of the ancient quarrel win for a while. So printing press supported the one side of the Baconian version of science, and the electric age retrieves the aphoristic side of Baconian science. And that's what McLuhan was trying to teach, how to look at information overload and look at the figure-ground relationships, ground being the technology. Like right now, we're doing digital post-Android meme technology here. Android means a subset, but we have total control, no obligation, and can communicate to billions of people, all of us, right here in this setup right here, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot different than going on 60 Minutes in 1969. And you're subject to, they edit the show, they don't even have you on, why have you on? So we're in a totally different, here comes everybody, actually, much like Finnegan's Wake portrays itself in its book, we are in a Finneganese electronic medium right now, digital medium, whichever term you want to use.
Now, as we go on talking about this, you're watching to see if Ion calls, correct?
Yes. Yes.
I would hate for me to be slithering on and miss Ion.
That's right.
Okay. Here's a neat, I'm going to quote something that I think encompasses what you just said. Maybe it doesn't. You can correct me if I'm wrong. McLuhan has a unique vision of his own that manifests itself through poetic images crafted by interplay within everyday life. The conflicts generated by the world of new media and the evolving techno-cultural world of human communication, McLuhan became a juggler of the video, the verbal, the audio, the tactile, and the interplay of all the senses within the central nervous system of the everyday person.
Yep.
Then there's another little bit about talking about
Could you read the first sentence of that? I missed the first sentence of that,
sure.
What you just read.
McLuhan has a unique vision of his own that manifests itself through poetic images crafted by interplay within everyday life, the conflicts generated by the world of new media and the evolving technocultural world of human communication.
What page is that?
Well, that you don't have it, because it's in the introduction to the paper.
More introduction. Okay.
Yeah, well,
see,
if you want, I can copy this and send it to you so you have
No, it's too crummy. It's not correct. It's half correct,
okay.
But it's lousy.
All right.
Let's read Don's words, not this introduction.
Okay, well, I thought they were Don's words. We'll just
Yeah. You see,
go on past
McLuhan,
this.
Here's what you got to notice. He writes to his mother when Mechanical Bride comes out in 51. He says, this is a new kind of novel, actually a science fiction novel, where the ads and the comics are the characters. So what does that mean? It means that he is not writing it. He is orchestrating like a painter, you know, a cubist painter, these images, and there's four parts on each section, and he's orchestrating them to present a drama that's science fiction-like and nothing to do with his opinion. He's creating a fiction. Now, what you just read doesn't say that. It just says he had a poetic vision and played with some modern media. No, that's too bland.
Okay.
And he begins with...
Well, there's... Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's it.
Well, there's a couple of things in here that maybe that you think they're coming, but I'm gonna tell them to you, and you tell me if you think they're coming. Because
yeah.
I thought this was really interesting. Whoever wrote this garbage mentioned that TV was light through rather than onto a screen, and I thought that was really interesting.
That's a major McLuhan point, and that is that is in Finnegan's Wake. The last section of Finnegan's Wake is a chapel, which is across from the tavern, which is the main scene in the book in Dublin, and the church has a stained glass triptych. So there's light through coming through this end of the book. And this is what you find. A lot of Marshall's writings are actually scenes from other writers speaking. So when Marshall goes on about light through versus light off the movie screen or light off the page, he is quoting a section of Finnegan's Wake. You see?
Mm-hmm.
This is what's interesting.
Well, then it is interesting. And that also
And what
resonates.
McLuhan would do, listen to this, McLuhan would find a scholar that supported that kind of stuff, that perception of medieval art, and stick it in there. And so the quote from someone else would be what a character in understanding media would be saying. You know what I mean? So that all the media in understanding media are characters that are speaking. And Marshall got the lines from Pound, Eliot, Joyce, Lewis, and other people. So it's just like my chart where I have the five vortices bouncing off each other, and they're the anthropomorphic version of radio, TV, computer, satellite, and anthropomorphic physical bouncing off each other. You see what I'm saying? So my chart is the menu of it's the playbill of the global theater. Well, Marshall was doing the same thing earlier phase. He didn't get to the homeopathic phase. And so he is, it looks like scholarship, but he's actually playing off the different media, and he leaves the quotes out. You don't know that, you know, page 15 of the book is being said by radio, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
And an example is, when you know Finnegan's Wake, you find that, well, Marshall's just citing a scene from Finnegan's Wake. He's not making up this thing about, he didn't find this data about the stained glass window. It was in Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Wake spoke at first before Marshall. So Marshall gathers together the data, and it's a play, it's a Socratic dialogue in a theatrical form.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So all that I just said is not said by that introduction. It is gotten to by Don, when you read Don closely. He doesn't say exactly like me, but he backs me up.
Yeah, you say it better than him.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, well, let's move on to the prelude then, McLuhan's basic probes and perceptions, and just not deal with that other thing. Okay, so in this prelude, talking about McLuhan's basic probes and perceptions. First, he talks about the four important factors that influenced Marshall, the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, the fact that his mother was an actress, his Catholicism, and the fact that he was an English literature professor.
Right.
So those were kind of the meat
That's
of
the beginning.
Of where all of it, that's the beginning.
Yeah, what that did, that gave him information that enabled him to be on top of the advertising world that would come in with television in the 50s. He serendipitously, accidentally, or parallel world set it up that he become an expert in obscure information that would be perfect to use to understand the new strange world of television.
Mm-hmm.
He had a strange mother. He had a different way of looking into Catholicism. He had an obscure background in medieval English Renaissance literature. He had done the PhD on the Trivium and the Quadrivium. None of these things anybody ever heard of in 1950. You know what I mean?
No. Yeah. Very old-fashioned.
Yes, very deep. And but he realized that television was going to retrieve medieval sensibility. So he had the story, the sources on medieval culture right away to have the book speak it and have subplots of television and radio speaking these facts of medieval culture.
Mm-hmm.
You see, at the time he's writing his books, he was also trying to get a Broadway musical going, which nobody knew about. He wanted to have a Broadway musical. Yeah, that he was ready to operate in any medium, and he had his, you know, he had his shit together by the mid 50s, and he was already that early trying to get some musicals and plays put on in New York City. And in the Broadway musical that we eventually learn about, he was going to have the media be characters. In other words, television would speak and radio would speak, all these different separate analog media, just like Mechanical Bride had the comics and the advertising being the characters. But now, and then, you know, 10 years later, he's going to present a wider landscape of media dynamics, not just the content of the Mechanical Bride book, 40 stuff.
Well, that would have been so interesting.
Yeah.
Better than Cats.
That's right. Now, in 1960, he's going to become famous by 1967 for coining the phrase global village. But you read a letter he wrote in 1960, which meant he had thought this out 10 years before. This is a letter to some corporate executive he probably didn't even know. He says that we have a global village of chaos. What we need is a global city. How would this global city, this global metropolis happen? He said it would be like an airport with the traffic controllers, you know, controlling flights, monitoring the flights. He says we need an air traffic controller for all the different media environments at some headquarters that would create the image of a global city. So you wouldn't build, you know, sort of suburban sprawl over the whole planet. You would orchestrate the media environments with computers and statistics right there in 1960. Now, that was his idea. That's what he was for, not global village, but the global city, a new civilization. Based on the technology we have. And that is never said anywhere. And no one ever said that, no journalist. Don says it. And his book is where you'll find that quote, and Don will highlight it. So isn't that amazing? The air traffic controller is the image of the new world government or media dynamic in a solar theater, solar government.
Wow.
See, it spreads your mind's imagery. It makes it bigger than the Madison Avenue version of McLuhan.
Much bigger.
Yeah.
Okay, so then we get into a little bit about how he was using the critical technique used to analyze poetry to analyze comics, ads, newspapers as poems, which is basically what birthed The Mechanical Bride.
Right. He took what he learned at Cambridge from I.A. Richards and F.R. Leavis and Wyndham Lewis, their technique, what's called the New Criticism, and applied those literary techniques to non-literary art forms, ads, movies, magazines, and comic books that no professor in his right mind would do. They would never apply new critical knowledge, new forms of poetic analysis to these dirty teenage media. You know what I mean? That's what was radical about McLuhan.
Very radical. And I don't think he did that to help.
Just to help what?
The kids.
No.
He saw they were cultural productions. He saw it as poetry. That's why
he saw that people didn't understand Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake and Pound's Cantos and Eliot's Wasteland. He knew the professors in the 20s and 30s and 40s didn't know that that's what Eliot, Pound, and Joyce were doing. They were using the pop culture. But, you know, you have your average literary Gutenberg dupe who thinks books are the highest level of culture, and they're not, they're reading books to ignore pop culture. And they end up reading, trying to read Finnegan's Wake or Pound's Cantos, and they can't understand it because it's got the dirty media in there. McLuhan was exposing what was the hidden ground of the radical modernists, that they they used these media, and it was not taught in the colleges in the 40s and 50s.
No,
they didn't know it. Marshall knew it.
No, they, in the academics, couldn't really cope with what was going on around them.
Right, and you can read a great letter, June 22nd, 1951, where McLuhan, you know, lambastes his colleagues at the University of Toronto. Goes on for two pages, writing to Ezra Pound, complaining about the dumb people that were so-called professors at the University of Toronto. He always infiltrated. He always considered his role in universities as an infiltration. He knew that universities would be a better audience for people, more secure financially. He could do whatever he wanted once he had tenure, which he got in 1952. Whereas if you were a struggling poet like Dylan Thomas or Jackson Pollock or Abby Hoffman or Bob Dylan, you'd be out there on the streets, vulnerable to your management, vulnerable to the whims of the audience. You might make a hit, and then you disappear. You know what I mean? But Marshall was in for the long run, so he says, okay, I'm going to become a teacher. At least I have access to young people there. I'll have the clout of a PhD. I'll get to be an advisor to corporations, and I'll do a new kind of poetry, a new kind of art, a mixed media art, as Steele calls it, media poetics. So, you know, you want to be a writer. Other people want to be a poet. Most people, not younger generations, don't want to be a writer. But the ones of the baby boomers and Generation X, they thought they had to write a book or write poetry. They didn't know that they'd been obsolesced by the media poetics of McLuhan. So they never were going to become outstanding because they had to know what McLuhan did to go past them. So most people try to be a novelist like you were doing, or, you know, write a book or enter the New Age market. You know, and it's a puny operation, and very it's like the lottery. And most poets didn't understand this. And what's interesting, Dylan was a poet, Zappa was a poet. They knew to go into the electric media, that rock and roll, you know, and doo-wop was the new poetry. And you don't get, you didn't get that taught to you in university in the 60s or the 50s.
No.
You were told to read Ed Norman Mailer or John Updike, you know, these book people. They came and went. See, we're talking about McLuhan because he wrote the biggest long-range stuff, covered decades and many generations. Who reads Rod McEwen now, a popular poet in late 60s out of Canada? Rod McEwen, not McLuhan, McEwen. Who reads anybody that's a poet, Allen Ginsberg, who reads them? Nobody. But the people that, the guy who grew up with them, or was with them in creating counter art to Ginsberg, was McLuhan. And they're still recycling McLuhan on all levels of society. They're not recycling Allen Ginsberg. Wired magazine didn't name Allen Ginsberg, or even Bob Dylan, as the patron saint of the new technology in the 90s.
No, they named Marshall.
Right, and there is a book done by a British scholar, leftist scholar, and he went to the archives in the Soviet Union and different places, and he showed how different intelligence agencies were using McLuhan as early as the 50s to envision strategies for the Cold War. He found the documents. They weren't using Allen Ginsberg or Leonard Cohen or Irving Layton or... who else? Even Bob Dylan. They weren't using those guys to figure out how to beat and win the Cold War. They were using McLuhan. See, he's like Erasmus. He's like St. Augustine. He represents a whole pivotal point over a 400-year period. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember, that's all obsolesced by the Android meme, which complicates it even more.
Right. It's still interesting.
Yeah.
What about Tom Wolfe, then?
Tom Wolfe promoted McLuhan in a certain way. Basically, Tom Wolfe emphasized that McLuhan was sort of developing a theory about the central nervous system and looked at the biological, neurological pathways and emphasized that. And that pissed Don off. So Don's going to correct. There's a whole chapter correcting Tom Wolfe.
Yeah, chapter four.
Right.
The Firehouse Boys.
You know, he even, you know, indicts Tom Wolfe as exploiting McLuhan for his New York media purposes.
Tom Wolfe's pretty successful. For sure.
Well, it's not about being successful.
No,
Tom Wolfe was successful because he learned McLuhan stuff. That McLuhan was a big influence.
Yeah, that was going to be my question.
Yeah, no, there's a famous book he wrote in the 70s on the art world called The Painted Word. It begins with him in the tub, in his bathtub, reading a newspaper. That's a McLuhan image. Direct from the 60s.
It is.
And then without saying McLuhan too much, he uses McLuhan's ideas to come up with a book that got him a lot of attention. But he's always using McLuhan.
And that's what I was getting at. Like, he was successful and was he because he was mimicking McLuhan?
Right. He was applying it to a cheeky new kind of journalistic style. So someone might read Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test to find out what the 60s were about. But that's not what you don't see Tom Wolfe being used by the Obama campaign. You know what I mean?
Right.
They're using McLuhan.
Right. Got it. Mm-hmm.
It's just like ION. See, ION is the new McLuhan, the new environment, the new hidden ground that is ignored by people all over the world, for the public as much as possible. But everybody's using ION in many ways or responding to it. I was just listening to an old reading last night, and Ian was telling me and Carolyn back in 2010, the people who were calling JW's family. I'm not going to say who they were, but I forgot about some of them. Big, 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 big names. And that was, we'd only been on the radio for 6 months when that was happening. So just like everybody was calling McLuhan in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
See, in the information society, the main job is a corporation has to come up with a platform, a statement of their corporate purpose for the shareholders and for media advertising. They got to state what they're apparently about. And so if someone has new ways of discussing, society and its dynamics, you're going to run to them. And, of course, that made a big industry. McLuhan was like one of the first moonlighters, the first guy to be a consulting, to get in on the consulting game in the 40s to corporations. But, you know, millions of people, many of your friends from high school are probably consultants now.
Mm-hmm. And Marshall wanted all.
Well, he wanted to be famous to be useful.
Okay.
You know, he wanted to make an impact on the world. He, in 1944, he goes back to Canada from St. Louis University, and he writes in his diary or someplace, I'm going to rip the hide off of Canada. So who wrote that? Did your father write that when he moved to Ohio? I'm going to rip the hide off of Ohio. You know?
No.
This guy had huge, you know, he's an artist. He's a genius. He thinks he's the smartest guy on the planet. And he thinks he should be paid attention to. So he goes around like a psychopath, going back to Canada. And he had, and this is what's good about Don's book. Don was there in the 50 to 53 period where Marshall felt he could confide in Don on his ambitions to get power. He confided with Don about what his plan was. And Don will tell the story that there was a major magazine newspaper owner who wanted Marshall to start writing a column for the newspaper, and Marshall was wondering how to do it. Now, Don's just a 23, 24-year-old, and Marshall's using him to bounce off ideas to see what the kid says. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So Don doesn't know fully what Marshall's really thinking until years later he figures it out, but he is hearing Marshall wondering about how do you have power today? How do you be an artist? You can't be a Picasso. That's been done. Marshall wrote in the 50s that Ezra Pound and them should have stopped in 1922 with their poetic agenda. They should have moved into modern media. Now, Dali did that, Salvador Dali. You know, he got involved with advertising and everything in the 30s and 40s. But anyways, McLuhan knows that he represents an anti-environment, a perceptive x-ray of the culture, like Ion is, and he is determined to be heard. And he can't do it in any traditional way. Not going to write a book or a novel or, you know, be a professor giving lectures. He does that, but that's not not his larger plan. He's available to consult with anybody. He's not like saying, oh, I, like Norman Mailer represented the hipsters in the mid-50s, you know, the white niggers they were called. And they were the beatniks and the hippies, and they had the agenda against straight society. McLuhan wasn't taking a sociological stance or a class stance and represented that gang against a bunch of other gangs. He was like acting like he was head of the CIA or Tetra manager, which is all spelled out in detail on my incredible essay on McLuhan called McLuhan and Holopathic Quadrophenia. The more you understand Don's book and then go back and read my essay, I'm spelling all this out. It's incomprehensible until you read Don's books, you know, to get a clue of what level I'm talking about. I mean, Marshall's own brother said, after Marshall died, he said, Marshall's not going to be understood for another 100 years. So what's that about? He is actually understood. He communicates. People made him famous. They thought he was saying something that they got. So what is it they don't understand? And that's what Don's trying to spell out in that book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, let's keep going then.
Yeah.
So after you talked about Mechanical Bride and the poetic analysis of cultural artifacts of that time, and then he gets into how understanding media came to be, and just talks about, let me see where I'm kind of lost my train of thought here. Well, that was just what he wrote next. There's something about, like, soft technologies. That's what I was trying to think of. So all of the cultural phenomena of his day are both cultural productions and soft technologies. And so that's what got him to start thinking about understanding media and how everything is an extension of man and all the different various media. You know, when I first read that, I remember talking to you and not understanding what media was. And at first, everybody thinks it's just the television or the newspaper and whatnot, and it's not. It's all of our cultural artifacts. So that's kind of what he got into next. And then he encountered Norbert Wiener. And I wanted you to talk to me a little bit about that, too. I used to be really interested in cybernetics. I read that Maxwell Maltz book. I don't know if you remember that, about psycho-cybernetics.
Yeah, that's a self-help book. That's not the world of computers.
Okay, so tell me this was computers. That's what he was all excited about?
Yeah. In the late 40s, there was something called the Macy Conferences with Margaret Mead and all these CIA and academic MIT, Harvard, Yale people were trying to figure out what to do with the new early computers. What will that mean for society? And Norbert Wiener led that thing, and he composed the term cybernetics. And that comes out like in 48, that book. The Don Field, a young undergraduate. Yeah, Don Field's a young undergraduate doing math in that era at Yale. So he writes a review of that book. Well, when he shows the book to McLuhan in 1950, McLuhan quickly absorbs what this gang at MIT were about. And he writes a letter to somebody saying, all the poets and writers who are writing for the little small mags, he calls them clacks. That might have been a term back then for the cliques who had the little magazines. He says, all these guys writing for clacks and literary small mags are puny compared to what's going on at MIT with Norbert Wiener. So Marshall realized that that's who he wants to satirize, not the Allen Ginsberg. He wants to satirize the Tetrad managers or those that work in huge data patterns for the Tetrad managers. So he takes Norbert Wiener, and he decides to move from analyzing advertising and pop culture in McKeown-Cabride to analyzing communications. So the early seminars of the explorations, he forms a team to analyze this, 53, 54, called the explorations gang, that then they were, you, the most of them were professors, and they put out a journal called Explorations in Communication. So the world of communication as a technical thing coming out of the Shannon Weaver model and those kind of systems that the new, call them digerati, the Illuminati of the digital revolution were mm-hmm. thinking about in the universities, that's who he wanted to satirize. And he knew Finnegan's Wake would help him. So he went after communications. That becomes an art form in the 60s, and he incorporates ads, and then the next level, communications, all becomes subsumed under the word media, which means everything, anything that humans make.
Mm-hmm.
So he went from advertising, cultural content, to communications, to media. And understanding media is a replay of his interest in advertising and communications of the 50s, in the 50s. He redid it as a satire in the book Understanding Media, which was a two-part project. That and Gutenberg Galaxy were what's called an Apelion, or a little epic. An Apelion, traditionally, in the history of literature, was something that explained the ways of God and the pain that people are having to the tribe. So he was going to explain the world to whoever listened in the media environment of the global theater of the 60s. And he did it with a two-pronged Apelion strategy of the Gutenberg Galaxy as one half of the Apelion and Understanding Media as the other half. And only Don knew that because he studied the Apelion with Don, with Marshall in the early 50s when he was writing an analysis of Alexander Pope's work. That's where Don discovered the work of the rare, obscure topic of the Apelion. So he certainly recognized what Marshall was doing, you know, 10 years later.
So, my book is an Apelion. Your book is an Apelion?
Yeah, Fatty Commune with Bob Dobbs is an Apelion.
Mm, I want to read that, too. So what was Wiener writing about, though? So cybernetics...
Oh, they were trying... Now, me and another guy talked to Norbert Wiener through the Evergreens on February 8th, 2001, and subsequent sessions, and we were asking what were they thought they were about. Well, you had the Cold War, and these professors are wondering, what do we teach our college students? What do we teach, you know, high schools? What are we going to, how we preserve American culture or whatever they thought they were going to preserve, allowing also new technologies to come in that would upset everything. So they were trying to figure out what is genius and how to teach genius. That's what Norbert Wiener told my friend and I in this session through the Evergreens. And certainly McClellan was part of that dialogue. He used to have a position on the temporary uselessness of the term genius. Anyways, they were trying to manage society, to figure out what to tell people, because they were moving into the Korean War. Nobody knew how far the big bombs would be used, and everybody was nervous. It was a very scary time in the early 50s. So a lot of the intellectuals were trying to formulate stuff to tell the president what to say. So McClellan entered that level.
But it wasn't about how to tell them the truth then. It was how to control people and how to control the fear.
Yeah,
to elicit
control
fear when that would have benefited.
Well, you
them.
Get different factions. You get the so-called right-wing faction of CIA just want to maintain the status quo and keep the fear thing going. You've got the liberal faction of the CIA and think tanks that are more optimistic in their belief in human nature, and they think actually we can go to a better world. And that's been the battle, you know, for a long time. And Lynn LaRouche's articles and his gang's books on this are very good analysts of, they are good analysts of that historical battle between the Platonists and the Aristotelians, at least for 500 years, might even go back 2,000 years. Now, Marshall called it an ancient quarrel in modern America. That was his first article after he had completed his PhD. He applied the history of Western civilization, the Trivium and Quadrivium, the battle between the Sophists and Plato. He summarized that, 1,500 years of that, and then he applied it to the United States in 1946 with this article, An Ancient Quarrel in Modern America, where there was a guy, forget his name right now, he started He was at the University of Chicago, Robert Hutchins, and he was tasked at Chicago, which was the old Rockefeller base, to create a cultural content for people for universities. And it was called the Great Books Program, and you have a picture in Mechanical Bride of the Great Books Program. You know the picture with, like, the 25 people with their little file cards? Mm-hmm. They're all there. It's one of the ads. So Marshall went and introduced himself to Robert Hutchins and presented an alternative way to organize education. And that was the Ancient Quarrel. Marshall goes on to write about his encounters with Hutchins and these guys in that essay, which is in his book Interior Landscape, a collection of his literary criticism. So Marshall knew what he was up against, what he was doing, what he represented. Big input from Wyndham Lewis on that stuff.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking when I was doing the dishes today about the art of being ruled.
Yeah.
And how Marshall was trying to teach us the art of being ruled not by government but by media.
Maybe what is rulership? What is governance personally, socially, psychologically, collectively when you have a global theater? That was the question. Who's ruling what? I mean, in 1947, they created the National Security Act where those who worked in intelligence, like, say, the DIA and the CIA, were allowed to lie to the American people if ever pressed to speak to the media. See? Because the Tetra managers knew it was a pretty complex society, and literary or pictorial information was not the ground of truth. You did not organize society on truth anymore. You had major environments that employed millions was part of the tension. How do you talk to that? So they allowed the public to put on their environment. So Americans had a great time in the 50s, 60s, pretending they ran the world as the greatest country that ever was. Little did they know that the software cultural programming was going to destroy America as they knew it. Create a new unrecognizable America, and that was part of Marshall's warning. He was like offering himself to advise the CIA, but with an outsider or Wyndham Lewis's theme of the enemy, a counter environment.
Wow!
The new form of poetry. A poet doesn't go to an open cafe on Monday night. That's for love job and comedians and wannabes. In 1953, you go to a cafe and read some poetry. Marshall went to MIT. He went to the University of Chicago and introduced himself, says, you guys need my poetry. And what was his poetry? A report he made, which was came out in 1960 for the National Educational Association of Broadcasters, which was so controversial they discussed and yelled at it in Congress. Now, that's a poem. Create this document that is useful for this institution and to get attention for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you can't do that unless you have a PhD. You're not even in the game unless you're in the university and teaching. You got a PhD. You're not eligible to be a consultant on that level.
Right. Wow. Suddenly, this is really kind of serious. Like, it's this.
Yeah. Yeah, duh.
It is. It's been really kind of fun and light, and went up to this book, and now it's kind of like, holy shit. Yeah, really.
Well, don't you? Aren't you a serious person?
Sometimes, yeah.
You're just a party girl. You're an INET. You just want to have fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, some people have said I'm really boring, so I don't know about that. And I'm sitting here on a Saturday night talking to you about McLuhan's basic probes and perception, so I guess that's partying to me.
See, to be a serious writer, I don't think you would do something to make money. You would figure out what you wanted to write and what should be said and heard. And that's what McLuhan was thinking. That was the level. He didn't have to worry about money. He had tenure, you know? So now he was applying, like any reasonably intelligent person, they tend to take society seriously, and they want to have a say in what happens as the future unfolds.
Yeah. Being an INF made me that way. I wasn't that way before.
Made you a little more serious? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
And more careful about making sure I don't say anything until I'm really sure what I want to say.
Right.
I haven't been sure what I want to say for the last 6 months.
Right. And I'm interested in what, if you can recall the state of mind you were in for many years, what's it like to be not caring? What are you doing? Are you just stimulating yourself, blabbing? What is it?
Yeah, I can't remember. I almost can't remember. I can't remember. God.
You can't remember what you would notice, who you would talk to, who you would be interested in, what you would want to know about.
No, I can't remember, but I know that life was. I'm more euphoric and blissful and joyous now, but it was almost easier. It was almost easier to not know this.
Right.
There was a time when I just thought I would, you know, work and then retire and die and watch some TV and not care. And now I'm like, well, now I want to say something important and say it at the right time and live forever.
Right.
And I have an eternity to do it. But at the same time, there's been a fire lit under my feet. So not that I want to rush anything, but
you have more of a sense of purpose, even though you wouldn't know what it was.
Way more of a sense of purpose. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what it is. I think I'll know soon. I think I'll know here in the next couple of weeks, actually.
Yeah, so listen to this. So you have McLuhan being a conventional guy using new techniques to wake up. He even says in this letter of June 22nd, 1951, two-pronged strategy. I will needle the somnambulist, that would be the average person listening to media, and distract the triggermen on the side. The triggermen are the CIA assassins and hit teams, you know, the people that Catherine Austin Fitz talks about. So he wanted to distract the CIA, and he also wanted to needle the average citizen. So nowadays, if you wake up somebody, where are they going to go? It was simpler back 50 years ago. You actually need to give them the RNA drops to even get them to the point of retrieving the role of having a purpose and pretending you're doing something seriously. You're feeling good because of the drops, therefore you can handle this analysis. But you're an average person today, and you don't know about the drops, you're not going to want to wake up. It's too overwhelming. You'll find out that you've been dead for 30 years, and there was no you, and that you're a virtual statistic.
Right.
You know?
Or there's the fake new age waking up.
Oh, yeah, well, they're silly. They're not, you know, the whole industry's marketing different ways to wake up. But real waking up, like finding out those people on my chart you never heard of and find out, ooh, man, look what they're writing. This is real education.
Right.
That's, quote, waking up. But you can see that that's okay in 1962, but in 2014, why are the kids and everybody staring at their little texting? They don't want to look. They don't want to see what's around them. They don't want to see that they don't exist. So we have a salute. We have to give the population the RNA drops so they can calm down, feel eternal, then they can pretend they're a concerned citizen.
Right. That's in my experience.
Yeah, and many others.
Yep.
Here.
Mm-hmm. For sure. In unique ways, which is really neat, too. Everybody does it their own way. Love that. Okay, so then let's continue on. He developed his ideas of hot and cool. Okay.
That was in the
50s. Again,
early 60s.
And again, we're just buzzing through the basics here. You know, and then Don went through all of his basic probes, orality, literacy, acoustic space, visual space, hot, cool, printed book and lineality, the medium is the message, tactility in the central nervous system, technology as the extending of the senses, interior landscape, global village, figure-ground interface, pattern rather than point of view, technological artifacts as effects, writing, alphabet, and printing press media involving codes, interdisciplinary versus specialism, Electricity and the Encyclopedic Paradox and Ambivalence. And all media and technology are languages. Each codifies reality differently, and each conceals a unique metaphysic. So
now let me tell you something. That inventory, and Don doesn't say this, that inventory of dialectics, hot versus cool, acoustic space versus visual space, those dialectics that you listed, imagine that is the computer speaking, and it's looking over the planet and the global theater and orchestrating all these media environments and all these populations and all these economies. It's going to have a quick formulaic mathematics, almost a mythic encapsulation, almost aphoristic, a short summary. These terms are how the computer would see society in the 60s. So understanding media is being written by a computer. Now, what's interesting is that Robert Anton Wilson went on in the late 70s and put out a novel called The Illuminatus Trilogy, which is on my chart. That novel, when you read it close enough, it's being narrated by a computer. Now, he was a student of McLuhan, so he turns that into a novel 20 years later. But here's Marshall presenting a book that looks like it's sociology, understanding media. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's practical advice for corporations and all that. But it's actually spoken by the computer, who was looking at what Marshall called the two-bit world. Computers, as they were programmed by literate men, were just two-bit yes-no operations. That's the digital. McLuhan was all for analog computers, not so much digital. So this two-bit wit of the computer landscape run at Langley, Virginia, say, or some other place in Ohio, that is a satire. Marshall, as a book writer, is satirizing how the computer organizes modern experience into these different media modalities based on sensory extensions. You see? See how you, you're learning the content as you read this. Read about McLuhan or read McLuhan. Look at that you're reading a script of an automaton, an android meme speaking, not Marsh McLuhan writing it. Get what I'm saying? So once you get used to the terms and the dialectical interrelationship of figure ground, then you can stand back and say, oh, yeah, this is how satellite programming would see the planet, and this book is containing the satellite attitude, is holding a mirror up to the satellite attitude.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then you would go back and say, okay, all these levels are in Finnegan's Wake. That's why Finnegan's Wake is written on so many tiers, T-I-E-R-S, so many levels, because it's the way a satellite or a computer environment or the Android meme would look at the planet and all the media on it. So here's Marshall simplifying the satire that was Finnegan's Wake. He's making Finnegan's Wake for dummies. He's making simple, using English words. He's not collaging 50 languages on each page, just one language, English. And he's showing this dialectical process through all the different cultures and media environments. And that is a simple version of the complexity that Finnegan's Wake is about. So Don Thiel wants to get people back to understanding how to look at Finnegan's Wake, because that's a perceptual act that Marshall didn't necessarily succeed in getting people to understand. He was all for doing that, but he actually got trapped or bogged down in his own fame, which he knew about, but a lot of agendas were hard to carry on once you're in the media mix and asking to be on Johnny Carson and stuff like that. And your fellow professors are pissed off that you're doing that.
And jealous.
Yeah.
Right? Were they jealous? I would think they'd be jealous.
Oh, yeah. They actually conspired in the 70s to take away his tenure, which you can't do in universities. But they were so pissed off at McLuhan at the University of Toronto, they tried to, what's that word, defrock him from his PhD, which was ridiculous. It's because he was world famous. He was Canada's most famous Canadian.
And then,
people in the universities were pissed off that he had gone out of his cage.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, then he gets into this Dylan Thomas poem. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, the five sovereign fingers of fate.
Yeah,
the five star fingers tax the breath. Yeah, tax the breath. Right. That's a good poem. Yep.
Yeah, it is a good poem. I didn't quite understand. Okay, so he had an essay that he published where he took the title from this poem, but the poem is also just terrific in and of itself about writing, right?
Yeah.
A goose's quill had put an end to murder that put an end to talk. And this is an incredible poem. Do you want me to read it? There's only like three stanzas.
Yeah, read
here.
It. Here. Yeah.
Okay. The hand that signed the paper. The hand that signed the paper fell to city. Five sovereign fingers taxed the breath. Doubled the globe of dead and halved the country. These five kings did a king to death. The mighty hand leads to a sloping shoulder. The finger joints are cramped with chalk. A goose's quill has put an end to murder that put an end to talk. Yet it also is, and I don't know if this is the third stanza in the poem, the hand that signed the treaty bred a fever, and famine grew and locusts came. Great is the hand that holds dominion over man scribbled by a name. I think that's deep.
Right. It's Dylan Thomas writing a history of the Gutenberg galaxy. Maybe he read McLuhan. Maybe he read Ezra Pound. Maybe he looked at media dynamics. It's a quick summary of what McLuhan spells out in many pages in the Gutenberg galaxy. He's talking about the effect of literacy in writing and how it obsolesced tribal murderous passionate life and created civilization and laws. So doesn't that end with the last line, hands have no tears to flow? Isn't that line?
Yes, it does. I don't know where that is, but I know I wrote it in my notes.
Yeah.
It could be a couple of pages.
That's a pretty good line. Hands have no tears to flow. Now, what you have is hands are tactile. You have the extension of, Dylan Thomas writes that. I think it was him. And he is just using language. He's speaking more than he realizes, probably. But Marshall says, no, that's a technically accurate statement. Electric media are extensions of our tactile sense, which are the hands. So when you have an environment that extends the central nervous system, the hand and the, quote, soul, to use Aristotle's terms, then you have a cold or cool society where people are not emotionally sentimental like they were before World War II. They're walking around in 1962 with sunglasses on, like Andy Warhol's image. They're being cool. They don't want to show the old fragmented sentiments. They don't have tears to flow anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Dylan Thomas stating an effect of the electric age, and Marshall comes along and explains what caused that effect. It's a result of the extension of the central nervous system.
Mm-hmm. So and then the mechanization of that.
It's the mechanization of the central nervous system, but it does not have the same effect as hardware, bulldozers, and steamships. When you have radio, the whole population is traveling instantly. They don't need to get on a plane. The software technologies are not limited to the old mechanical hardware effect. They have the software technological effect. Instant transportation of all populations once they have radio. That puts Ford out of work. Ford is trying to get people to travel by car. But people can travel by radio.
Mm-hmm.
So the cool society comes in, retrieved tribal society, with the Andromeda making more and more people live in their own little matrix as the digital technologies come in. So you have kids. If you look at the TV show Shameless, which is about a family at the bottom of the economic ladder of the United States in a real bad ghetto situation, and you watch the daughters, the 13-year-old and the 16-year-olds, how they live their life in the malls. These are little kids trying to get laid as soon as possible, and they're watching their imagery on the computer and doing all these things, smoking, drinking, acting cool. They do not have emotional sentiments that people had 100 years ago. Teenagers or adolescents had emotions. They were supposed to just sit there and wait till the lover came along, and they'd read some poetry about it. Now, McLuhan did a satire of this in 1960 on CBC. They showed the old teen or pre-teen courting rituals of 100 years ago, well, 1960s, say 1880s, and then they showed the modern rock and Elvis Presley teenager. You can get a book, Project 69, where McLuhan's details, and they have the transcript of this TV show. It's pretty interesting to read it. It might even be partly on YouTube somewheres. Anyways, the contrast between the Gutenberg era of youth with the television era of electronic Jujube's youth. One has sentiments, the later phase doesn't. You get what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. Yep.
So, tears, we have no tears to flow once we have television mm-hmm. in our home.
Here's the context in which they put the concluding line of Thomas's poem, in which Don put that. He's talking about, I think, TV. Let me see what he's talking about. Yeah, TV completes the cycle of mechanization of the human sensorium. The omnipresent ear and moving eye, we've abolished writing. By so doing, we have regained our wholeness on a cosmic plane. Being back in acoustic space, but on a new level, we must seek a new language for this technological culture and our new tribalized world of primitive feelings, so that McLuhan's concluding line in the essay is the concluding line of Thomas's poem, Hands Have No Tears to Flow.
Right. See, so he's writing, that's from Explorations, about 1955. So he writes this aphoristic essay, but he ends artistically with a quote out of nowhere. Nobody would know where that quote was, generally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But so he's showing that he's speaking poetically, aesthetically, artistically in that little manifesto
mm-hmm.
by ending with that quote.
This is, it's cool.
Did I say that TV show was called Shameless? The one I was talking about, the kids?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, Shameless. Take a look at that show.
Okay.
Anyways, yeah, that's, and he is at one of the rare times he uses the word cosmic. He generally
mm-hmm.
would not use that word. But what you just read, he uses it. He
mm-hmm.
says, we are changing reality on a cosmic level, on a cosmic plane. That is anticipating what Cosmic Awareness said in 67, where Rai, the original separateness, goes back to the plane of essence. That's cosmic
mm-hmm.
plane talk.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to unmute, and let's see if anybody wants to join in. Let's see.
Yeah, and this is
in.
Only, we haven't even, we haven't even done the introduction. Like, there's another introduction before you even get to chapter one.
Yeah,
and
no problem.
Gonna, okay.
The Finnegan's Wake Society in New York, they've been going for 20 years, and they've only done about 100 pages of Finnegan's Wake.
Well, just so everybody knows, and then we can totally switch topics. I'll shut up. We can move on to something else. But
no,
we've covered the first. Well, whatever. I'm just saying we can stop talking about this book if you guys want. This is the first 13 pages.
Right. Okay, so I've unmuted a lot of people. You can speak if you want to engage us and Katie. Might as well. There's no Ion's not here yet. Better start talking.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey, this is Sarah.
Okay, Sarah. Yeah, well, you have something to say?
Not particularly. I'm just curious.
Well,
I don't know
we're
where
talking
you guys...
about this.
I'm listening. I'm listening to you guys. I'm just wondering what is going on with the Katie sessions. Like, what kind of contributions do you want from other people?
Whatever you want. Whatever you're inspired to say. There's no rules. Like, don't you have any ideas or notions from what you've heard us talk about?
Yeah, no, I do. I'm just...
Well, say them.
It's rehashing what you guys already talked about, though.
So what? You won't say it exactly.
Okay. Well... okay, I'm interested... before, I asked particularly about your quote from Facebook. Can we start with that?
Yeah, what's about the ecology of sense?
Yes. I use ecology of sense to support my quadriphrenic advocacy. It is not Thompsonistic. Okay, can I full stop there? What, quote unquote, I know that Thompsonistic is implied by a different person. Would you even use that as a term?
No. So you, what I'm talking about is that we've got the five bodies, mm-hmm. Chemical, astral, TV, chip, and mystery body merging. Mm-hmm. And to the point where there's not even any separate bodies almost. We can still use it in analysis because everybody's behind us. But we, as you live today on the drops, living in a seamless web that you can drop anytime, you don't even have to be involved with the seamless web because you get that kind of a detachment from our completement products, then what is it that you're engaged with? You're engaged with making sense. So I read page 31 a couple of weeks ago from Thiel's book, Beyond the Word, where he analyzes three levels of meaning of sense. You know, he goes back to the etymological meanings and works through the different levels. That's what we're doing. We're engaging in new senses, new matter, new substance, and new interplay of our post-ionic senses. So we are engaged in an ecology of sense, but it's not sense as the eyeball sense and the ear sense. This includes that, but you've got five bodies worth of senses. You know,
right, and yeah, I think it's good to go back to the very beginning of your statement there and say you said you can use the bodies. So the bodies are now tools or areas, kind of, because we're not limited to one?
Right. They are sensory organs.
Right. So it's
we make sense with them.
Okay, right. And then they can be used to create better sense of sense.
Yeah, enhance your sensory or dumb it down. So making sense and knowing the multiple meanings of sense, then you're going to do an attempt to balance it or have a sense of proportion, not fanatically, not visually proportioned, not acoustically proportioned, but a sense of proprioceptive balance. That would be an ecology. So I'm taking all the bodies and saying that the hexadic level, the ionic level, is encountering, making sense via ion's input. So with ion, we're engaging an ecology of sense, not media ecology, not paramedia ecology, not Android meme. We're past that when we're engaged with the drops and the ion effect. So I thought his phrase was really good. And you read his books, he goes into the essence of communication. What is the drama of communication? Like real basic stuff. I think most people find the book too dry. If they actually had the guts to read it, they'd find it a little more interesting. But he does it with the raw stages of apprehension. He goes on, he keeps talking about communication, technology, and culture, and art, and interplaying those four words, and brings in comedy, satire, drama, the tactile, all of it trying to explain this new situation, which has no categories, in calling it an ecology of sense. And he's countering William Irwin Thompson's hero, Gregory Bateson, who came up with a book in the 70s called Steps to an Ecology of Mind. And Thiel, in his 1995 book, Beyond the Word, he analyzes what Bateson means by ecology of mind, says it's useful, but it's found wanting, and a better phrase would be ecology of sense, with a multiple meaning of sense. So we are, and Don Thiel once asked me, what quadrant am I in? He asked me, and I said, you're in my quadrant. All right? So
was that because he was interacting with you, or do you hold him there?
And also because he was a Joycean expert, and my quadrant is James Joyce's quadrant. And he was one of the closest guys to understand McLuhan the way I did. So definitely he was in my quadrant. Well, as I reread his books, he certainly is in my quadrant and is providing a language for the ionic, at least an intellectual language. We don't have to use it. We're not limited to it. But in the course of general terms, his books are very useful. That's what was fun reading them. I said, holy shit, this is he's talking about how you interact with something like ion when non-physical becomes an environment. What is your sensory organization? How do you make sense of ion, right?
Right. And then it does become necessary to have that dry, here it is, here's how it's done, use these words, you can't fail this, because it can be very overwhelming and confusing, and the validation that it is just this simple is worth having.
Right.